Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 55. I'm Jerry Iverson with my guest David Shy, author and educator, speaker and consultant. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue after the interview. David E. Shy, spelled S-H-I, served as the 10th president of Furman University from 1994 to 2010 and continues to be a leading figure in American higher education. A prolific writer and speaker, David has shared his knowledge of such topics as American history, sustainability, and leadership with thousands of people in the corporate, higher education, and nonprofit sectors. As a consultant, David has helped organizations and communities strengthen their ability to work with their constituents and achieve their objectives. David regularly travels across the country for speaking engagements and consulting partnerships. He wrote the classic, The Simple Life, Plain Living and High Thinking in American Culture, in 1985, and the updated version was released in 2007, as well as In Search of the Simple Life, American Voices, Past and Present. He is also co-author with the late George B. Tyndall of the best-selling textbook America, A Narrative History, now in its 9th edition, which has sold over 2 million copies. His efforts for sustainability are fascinating and inspiring. I hope you'll read his brief bio. See the link in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. A technical note about this episode. The first half of the interview is actually a presentation given by David as a regional TED Talk in Greenville, South Carolina. The second half is a conversation we had by cell phone because, as he explained, he lives on a mountaintop in western North Carolina and has no landline. You may notice a difference in sound quality. His insights are well worth any extra effort.
Our next presenter is Dr. David Shy, and probably most of you know him as the president of Furman University. You hear his voice on the radio as he presents his commentary on the EPR or NPR stations across the state of South Carolina. He does that from up here. But one of the things you might not know is that before that life of fame, he'd actually written 2 books on living a simple life. And I actually have them here in my hand. And they're his, so you probably can't buy them. But I would just let you know that there's more, even more, to David Shy than you absolutely knew about. And he's here to talk to us about living the simple life. Dr. David Shy.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Very good. I'm not going to ask you to walk on broken glass today, but I am going to ask you to walk more lightly on the earth today. And tomorrow, and next year. Today I want to indulge in one of life's great pleasures, perhaps its greatest pleasure, telling other people how to live. My goal is very simple. I want to provoke you to reflect upon who you are, where you're headed, and what you value most. In the process, I want to discuss the elusive ideal of simplicity as a tantalizing path to happiness. Are you willing to listen?
Yes.
Baxter, are you listening? Vicky? Simplicity has deep roots in all of the world's great religions and philosophies. Give me neither poverty nor wealth, but only enough, says the biblical author of Proverbs, while the Taoists believe that those who know they have enough are truly rich. Now, amid the prolonged stresses and strains of the Great Recession, more Americans than ever before are attracted to the ideal of plain living and high thinking. Last March, the editors of Time magazine published a cover story entitled, "The End of Excess. Is This Crisis Good for America?" They noted the chastening effects of the recession that have led many people to rethink their priorities. "We cannot go back to business as usual," Time magazine declared. "People must become less self-indulgent and revert to sanity and normal living." I suspect that the recession has led you as well to rethink your own notions of the good life, whether you wanted to or not. Those of us in this room have grown up within a relentless consumer culture that dominates American life. In the 80s, Madonna proclaimed that she was a material girl living in a material world. She then added, "They can beg and they can plead, but they can't see the light, because the boy with the cold hard cash is always Mr. Right." Such unabashed consumerism drove the economy during the 80s, the 90s, and the first decade of this century. From multiple credit cards to home equity loans to second mortgages, legions of consumers extended their purchasing power by borrowing heavily to finance discretionary purchases. And as a result, consumer debt grew almost twice as fast as the gross national product. We came to believe that nearly every need can be met, every anxiety relieved, every want satisfied by acquiring something more, something new, something better. But in fact, it rarely turns out that way. Hidden beneath the superficial appeal of life in the fast lane is the disturbing fact that the three most frequently prescribed drugs in this nation are an ulcer medication, a hypertension reliever, and a tranquilizer. One result of our preoccupation with more money and more things has been increasingly excessive work schedules, especially among white-collar professionals. Work at its best is a calling rather than simply a career, a passion rather than a profession. Work in its ideal sense involves something that engages us, excites us, inspires us. It connects us with something bigger than ourselves. But all too often, our work is in fact more deadening than devotional. It becomes the be-all and end-all of our existence. In white-collar sweatshops across the nation, more and more people are arriving earlier and staying later. Today, the typical corporate or professional worker spends 4 hours longer on average each week than in 1980 on the job and takes 20% fewer vacation days. Something has to give. A New York management consultant last month reported that everybody is exhausted and nobody really thinks things are going to get any better. We've become addicted to a daily routine of frenzied hurry. People feel shackled to their high-octane jobs, skipping lunch hours and taking laptops, beepers, Palm Pilots, and cell phones home at night. As the Lexus commercial boasts, "Sure, we take vacations. They're called lunch breaks." We now operate within such a culture of frenzy that too much work is still not enough. One writer has called this the acceleration syndrome, a high-tech lifestyle that makes us all behave like whirling dervishes, spinning out of control to maintain our runaway routines. The other day, in fact, a young woman was rushing across the Furman campus and actually accidentally bumped into me. She looked back over her shoulder and apologized as she resumed her haste, breathlessly explaining that, "I'm late for my relaxation class." Henry David Thoreau saw the same frantic behavior in the 1840s. At one point, he asks in Walden, "Why should we live with such hurry and waste of life?" Time magazine posed the same question in a cover story titled "The Rat Race." The editors reported that the work ethic in white-collar America has gone berserk. Simply to remain competitive, the story noted, professionals find that their lives are one long, continuous workday, bleeding into the wee hours of the night and squeezing out any meaningful leisure time. The rat race can be exhilarating, especially if your work is intrinsically rewarding. But as Lily Tomlin says, even if you win the rat race, you're still a rat. So it's in this context that the ancient ideal of simpler living is witnessing a widespread revival. Polls show that 20% of salaried employees have exchanged fewer working hours for lower salaries in the last 2 years. Such so-called downsizers are using imagination, conviction, and resilience to embrace the concepts of sustainability, energy conservation, environmental stewardship, and conscientious consumption. Corporate executive Paul Hawken calls it the largest social movement in all of human history. The editors of The Economist magazine believe that the simplicity trend will survive the revival of the economy. Now, they say, many people no longer seem consumed by the desire to consume. Instead, they're planning to live within their means, and there's been a backlash against bling. Advertising and marketing experts label this new trend downshifting or living lightly. Are you ready to begin downshifting? Are you eager to clean out the clutter in your life? If so, then you first need to know that simplicity is more a state of mind than a particular standard of living. Mindful simplicity encourages us to be more conscious and conscientious about the making and spending of money and the investment of our time, our most precious resource. It means, very simply, leading a balanced life. It means restraining our material desires and regaining control of our calendars so as to nourish higher priorities such as faith, family, wellness, the arts, or social justice. Those who choose a simpler life often discover that pressures are reduced, the frenetic pace is slowed, and new and better priorities are established. Yes, less can be more. Small can be beautiful. But simplicity is neither easy nor simple. Socrates pointed out over 2,000 years ago that most people will not be satisfied with the simpler way of life. They will be for adding sofas and tables and other furniture and dainties and perfumes and incense. For simplicity to be sustainable, it needs to be sincerely embraced rather than grudgingly accommodated. One must choose it, or as the Puritans would have said, one must be chosen for it. "'Tis a gift to be simple," sang the Shakers, and their message still rings true 200 years later. The good news I share with you today is that simpler living can be more than an anachronism, a fad, or an eccentricity. It doesn't require a rural homestead or a monastic regimen or a faddish preference for L.L. Bean boots, trail mix, and alfalfa sprouts. Purposeful simplicity, in its essence, involves a deliberate daily ordering and reordering of our personal priorities so as to distinguish each day between the necessary and the superfluous, the useful and the wasteful, the beautiful and the vulgar. This so-called Great Recession has brutally positioned us at a fork in the road. Climate change, population growth, environmental degradation, and the excesses of our heedless consumerism are creating one of those rare moments in history, a tipping point of unstable urgency that allows for incredible change in a short period of time. One path leads to an America that remains in denial that there is any reason for us to change our short-sighted ways. The other path leads to an America that acknowledges that there are limits to our exploitation of the environment and to our self-indulgent and short-sighted behavior. Yes, growth is inevitable. Indeed, for Greenville to be sustainable, it must grow. How we grow, however, is a fundamental question. We can grow chaotically, by chance, allowing our future and that of our grandchildren to be dictated by market forces that foster a sprawling, exploitive style of development, or we can grow by choice. That is, we can exercise our innate human ability to take the long view, to think consequentially, taking into consideration the fragility of our ecosystems, the limits of our natural resources, the virtues of our cultural and historic heritage, and the quality of our lives together. Thoreau appreciated the challenges and difficulties of taking the long view and swimming against the tide of prevailing attitudes and behaviors, but he closed his account of his experiment in simple living at Walden Pond with words of timeless reassurance. "I learned this by my experiment in simplicity," he wrote, "that if one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours." In that regard, I wish you good luck and Godspeed in your own efforts to pursue the happiness residing between too little and too much. It is, my friends, the only sustainable form of happiness we can pursue. Thank you.
Well, David, you have a reputation for being a historian, as well as a college president. I'd like you to put on your futurist cap for this part of the conversation and tell us, since your book was on Simple Living was originally published in 1985 and then revised, I think, in 2007, and because the TED Talk we heard was 2010, can you bring us your current ideas of the voluntary simplicity movement? You work with a lot of students. So what are you sensing out there on the ground in terms of the interest in voluntary simplicity now?
Well, first of all, let me thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners. I wrote two books in the mid-1980s about the ideal of simplicity in the American experience, and it has been a very persistent ideal ever since the colonial period. People have tried to lead lives of enlightened restraint when it comes to material things and money, so that they can devote most of their time and energy and loyalty to higher pursuits, whatever they might be. So that ideal has always persisted in the American experience, and periodically there have been surges of interest and commitment and expansion among those who try to lead simpler lives. And that was certainly the case just a few years ago in the context of the shocking impact of what has come to be called the Great Recession that struck the United States economy in 2008 and then really devastated things in 2009, and then, you know, of course, affected the whole global economy. And initially it seemed that the Great Recession, the shock of it and the trauma of it, like other periodic economic recessions or depressions and burst bubbles, was going to provide a painful incentive for Americans to rein in their runaway lifestyles and abandon the hyper-consumerism and chronic indebtedness that have come to characterize modern American life. In fact, you may remember that during late 2008 and 2009, newspapers and magazines were festooned with articles about the chastening effects of the Great Recession on American values. I remember many forecasters, many futurists in 2009 predicted that this was going to produce the greatest transformation in American values and lifestyles in decades, and it was going to shift away the American preoccupation with consumption and debt towards frugality and simplicity and plain living. But alas, that hasn't happened. While indeed there was evidence in those early years that people were downshifting their runaway lives, that was largely because they were forced to rather than they were choosing simplicity. And that's a very important distinction. As I mentioned in both of my books, voluntary simplicity is probably the most appropriate term because obviously millions of people over the centuries have been forced to lead simple lives by their circumstances or by their political systems. And I was focused on those people who had chosen to lead lives of voluntary simplicity. I remember that Paul Hawken, whom you may know as the founder of the company Smith & Hawken, and who has been a very prominent entrepreneurial ecologist, he predicted in 2007 in a book he wrote called Blessed Unrest that the mass interest in voluntary simplicity was going to become the largest social movement in all of human history. Well, however much we might wish that were the case, there was in fact little historical or contemporary evidence that Americans or any other people have in large numbers for long periods of time sustained a commitment to simplicity. And that's certainly the case now. We have very quickly reverted to the same freewheeling consumption that had helped trigger the Great Recession, and we're pretty much back to that norm. I was interviewed many times during the Great Recession, 08, 09, and I remember talking to a Washington Post reporter and explaining that even though I'm a historian, people do ask me to try to look into the future, and I do so with a historian's gaze. That is, there has never been a successful, prolonged societal commitment to simplicity in the American experience, other than just isolated examples of localized experiments, such as the Amish or the Mennonites or the Moravians, or, of course, the original Puritans in New England. Now, that raises the obvious question, why is it? Why has simplicity never been a majority ethic? Why has it always been a minority ideal? And not surprisingly, a lot of very intelligent people have wrestled with that issue. And the answers are many and not definitive, but I guess some obvious ones spring to mind. Anthropologists suggest that human beings, by their very nature, are acquisitive creatures. That is, our hunting and gathering instincts, going back to Neanderthals, suggest that humans want to accumulate more than they need. Perhaps that's just by the nature of wanting physical security over time. But whatever the reason, some people suggest that simplicity is not a natural way of living. Others, of course, focus on more contemporary reasons, and such as the emergence of this incredibly ubiquitous and powerful consumer culture that surrounds us every day and barrages us with tantalizing appeals to buy more, to get something new, something better, something different, that happiness is something we can purchase rather than pursue. Likewise, if we look back historically, those individuals and groups that have been able to sustain a commitment to enlightened simplicity have largely been people animated by some powerful spiritual or ethical motive, some sort of transcendent reason for leading a simple life, plain living and high thinking. And without that, most people who do move in that direction rarely succeed. Without that foundational commitment to some transcendent ideal above their material circumstances. So, human nature as well as historical evidence suggests that the future is simplicity as a way of living, a mode of life, is probably going to be what it always has been, and that is a way of life practiced by a determined minority who are committed to it for more than just economic reasons. That's a long answer, but it's a difficult question.
Well, thank you for those insights, indeed. I'd like to talk a little bit more about your work. And tell us, if you would, about the Shai Center for Sustainability.
Well, for 16 years, I had the privilege of being the president of my undergraduate alma mater, Furman University, outside of Greenville, South Carolina. And during the course of those 16 years, like any other president and any other college, we initiated a couple of different strategic planning exercises. And one of those exercises in the 1990s led us to articulate what we thought were our foundational values, one of which was environmental responsibility. So in implementing that strategic plan, we tried to position ourselves as an undergraduate college that was distinctively committed to environmental responsibility, what has since come to be known as sustainability. And we did a number of things and created a number of programs and initiatives and practices and tried to change behavior. And 6 years ago, on the verge of my retirement, Furman's Board of Trustees decided to name a new Center for Sustainability in my honor as a token of their appreciation as I did retire. So that center currently operates on campus and has a very national scope and reputation promoting sustainability, environmental responsibility, environmental justice, both on campus in the local Greenville community, statewide, and indeed nationally and internationally.
Well, let's take that one step further and tell us a little bit about the group called Second Nature.
Second Nature is a nonprofit organization based in Boston that was founded over 20 years ago, primarily for the purpose of facilitating higher education's commitment to environmental responsibility. And probably the focus of that organization's efforts has been the creation of what has come to be called the President's Climate Commitment. It has a much longer name, but it means college and university presidents across the country who were encouraged to sign a commitment to lead their campus to a posture of climate neutrality, carbon neutrality, by initiating an array of substantial projects and initiatives that would reduce their consumption of fossil fuels. That project has been surprisingly successful, with almost 700 colleges and universities on board the climate commitment. And those institutions represent about a third of all undergraduate students in the United States. So it was a very ambitious idea that has been transformed as a result of Second Nature's activities into an ongoing project of tremendous international significance.
Wonderful. Is there any connection now, after 20 years, between Second Nature and the divestment movement, trying to get colleges to divest from fossil fuels?
Yes, that is one of the primary tasks of Second Nature. In fact, its founder, a remarkable man named Tony Cortese, who lives in Boston, he retired a few years ago as the CEO of Second Nature and has focused his time and energy since on that very issue, that is encouraging colleges and universities to divest their endowed funds from carbon-producing or carbon-generating corporations.
Well, that's very encouraging indeed. There are some commentators, Tom Hartman for one, who has written a book called The Crash of 2016. And his theory is that we usually have downturns at presidential election time. So putting on your futurist hat, do you see any danger, serious danger looming in 2016?
Well, I would be very cautious about isolating any particular year in the future and trying to claim that it is going to be the time when some major event or catastrophe occurs. But it is true, over the long sweep of America's economic history, that recessions and depressions are endemic to the very nature of capitalism. The ebb and flow of prosperity is unfortunately one of the inherent structural aspects of a capitalist economy. And with great regularity, just as we have had waves of prosperity and abundance generated by American capitalism, we have also had shockingly traumatic recessions and depressions. And Of course, many people argue that the bull market that the nation has enjoyed over the last 8 years or so is running out of steam, and suggest that we may be in for another downturn, whether it's a recession or depression or something else. It's hard to gauge, but certainly it's the case that historically America has experienced a boom-bust cycle with great regularity, and some of those busts have coincided with presidential election years.
Thanks for your insights. Anything else you'd like to share with our listeners, particularly about the current status or the future status of the voluntary simplicity movement?
Well, not surprisingly, I personally have great affection for and interest in the ongoing efforts around the country to promote simpler living as a viable way of life. And it's given me great pleasure over many decades to immerse myself in reading about and discussing with those people who have promoted simplicity, well, like yourself. I think that movement is probably as well organized now and tuned in, if you will, to the pulse of American life than it has ever been before. And as an academic historian, I've had the good fortune of being able to write about a phenomenon that I personally am interested in and committed to. You know, more often than not, historians are writing about people and organizations and activities and movements in the distant past that have no contemporary relevance. And yet here I was able to write a book about many of the ideals that in the 1970s and 80s I personally and my family were trying to embrace and adopt. So it was a unique opportunity for me to find a project like that integrated the personal with the professional, my vocation as historian with my avocation as someone promoting environmental responsibility and personal self-reliance and frugality. So it's been a joy to be a part of this phenomenon, both as a scholar and as a practitioner. And I can assure your listeners that indeed simplicity, while perhaps the most complex and difficult of all forms of living, has its special rewards. Even though I've written many different books that have nothing to do with simplicity, it's the Simple Life books that I still get more requests to talk about or make presentations about. And having done that probably 200 times now, I think a practical point to convey to people is that simplicity is complex in that trying to step out of the mainstream of our corporate and consumer cultures today is extraordinarily difficult. And every day brings its own challenges and requirements for compromise. And I often give them this example of the ambiguity of simplicity in this consumerist world in which we operate. Years ago, in mid-December, my mother called and hesitantly asked if our young daughter at that point had one of the wildly popular Cabbage Patch babies. And I said, she did not. And why? Why was she asking? She said, well, I wanted to get her one for Christmas. And I knew that you wouldn't buy her one, so I thought I would. So there's a perfect example of the tensions generated in everyday life by pursuit of simplicity in the context of a very different society. So here I had the dilemma of trying to sustain my own principle about buying such faddish presents and satisfying my mother's desire to be generous to her granddaughter. Well, in the end, we found ourselves the owners of a Cabbage Patch Baby.
Oh, David, that's beautiful. Oh, as a grandfather, I can empathize with that so much. Oh, David, that's so beautiful. Well, thank you so much for your time.
And thank you for all you're doing.
You've been listening to my conversation with author, educator, speaker, and consultant David Shai. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com or on my Facebook page or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click on window number 3. The classic Advent Christmas resource, Whose Birthday Is It Anyway? 2010 was the last edition distributed on paper. Since then, I have published it on the internet. Whose Birthday is available in multiple formats in 2015 to meet your personal, family, and community needs. Number 27 is a free online collection. It's on our website now. Use as much as you need in print or online. Also, contribute your art and articles to Simple Living Works for it. Take a look at the guidelines. Send it in right away, electronically if possible. That's one thing that's nice about online publishing. It can be updated any time. Now, a legacy Whose Birthday is scheduled for release as a Simple Living Works podcast series in November and December. It can also be used as text or audio. Its calendar matches the lectionary cycle C. Regular listeners may think, well, didn't we hear that last year? Alternatives produced over 25 editions, so this year's audio series is different from the previous years. And thirdly, you can do it yourself. Yes, you can produce your own customized do-it-yourself Whose Birthday. You're welcome to assemble and copy a version that meets your local needs. All of our resources and services are now free of charge. So first, you create it. Select items most appropriate for your congregation or group, including graphics. Add some of your own original material if you choose. Numerous links for articles and art are given in the show notes. Second, produce it. Assemble the items in an attractive way using publishing software probably already on your computer for a paper edition or electronic software for an internet-based version, using PDFs of a paper version or a template for a newsletter version. Thirdly, distribute it. Upload it to your website, hand out copies to your congregation or group at a worship service or meeting, or by mail. Make additional copies available to share with friends and relatives. But please do not sell for a profit. Simple Living Works is part of the Creative Commons license. And fourthly, promote it. Tell people where it's available using social media and any other ways available to you, such as newsletters, worship bulletins, posters, etc. It's time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works Podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works Podcast and would like more information about Simple Living Works, please listen a little bit longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works Podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want, with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast and to our weekly blog are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, in iTunes. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. Send us your email address to receive our free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive lifestyle. It's not a list of rules, nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everyone's needs, but not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, "Live simply, that others may simply live," as our closing theme song proclaims. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the five life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre, and I've discussed these standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The three parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.
Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.